From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Bitcoin, the digital currency, has doubled its value in just the last 2 months. Today, one Bitcoin is worth about $2,400. Some people love it as an alternative to traditional payment methods, but it has a reputation for being used nefariously in the darkest recesses of the internet. And now competitors are nipping at Bitcoin's heels. This hour on Point, the skyrocketing price of Bitcoin and the appeal of alternative currencies. You can join us on air or online. Have digital currencies lived up to their potential in your view? Do you own or use Bitcoin or some other alternative currency? Do you worry about the risks? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me from New York is Paul Vigna. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and he's the editor of its MoneyBeat blog. He's also the author of the 2015 book, The Age of Cryptocurrency, How Bitcoin and the Blockchain Are Challenging the Global Economic Order. Paul Vigna, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha. Thanks for having me.
I think we could first use a 101 from you, a little primer in terms of definitions and nomenclature. So for people who still find Bitcoin something very abstract and very limited to the tech world, tell us what it is.
Right. Well, you know, that's funny. We will spend the next hour actually trying to define exactly what it is. And even people within the Bitcoin world are really still trying to figure out exactly what this is going to be. I mean, the argument, is this a currency? Is this a commodity? Is it an asset? Is it a token? Is still kind of raging. In my mind, though, it's primarily a currency. It is a currency, and it is also sort of a payment system. It's a network of rails. The idea is that this is a stateless currency that is not backed by any one central party, that operates – it's literally software is what it literally is. But the software operates on a network of computers that are connected, but they're not controlled by any one point. Every transaction within this computer system is broadcast publicly. What this does is it creates an open ledger of transactions that is protected and can't be altered. And what that does is hopefully, and it has so far, it makes it impossible to alter that ledger, so that what you end up with is a system where when a transaction goes through, nobody really doubts its validity. And the idea is that you get rid of the middlemen who, basically banks that would guarantee transactions for two counterparties who might not be in the same room, like Felix Salmon and I are right now. We might be on different sides of the country or in different countries.
And what is appealing to some people of getting rid of that middleman? Is it a sort of a libertarian distrust of government?
Yeah, there's a pure efficiency angle to it. This works faster, it's cleaner, it's cheaper. There is certainly the appeal of, there's the anti-bank idea that banks just kind of sit in the middle of these transactions and take their pound price, and sometimes they take too much, and sometimes they tank the whole system because they get greedy. So you kind of get rid of them, and you have this cleaner system. So you do have that sort of – and then there's the really radical sort of anarcho-crypto-fascist front, which wants nobody involved and wants complete anonymity and wants no banks or governments involved in anything.
But with anything digital, is there ever complete anonymity?
No, and there's a guy named Ross Ulbricht who is about to spend his life in prison, and he found that out pretty painfully.
The hard way. So whereas the money that most of us have used for all of our lives is backed by a government of some sorts and exists right in some tangible way, Bitcoin is not those things.
No, Bitcoin is absolutely not those things. And another advantage of it, if you're looking at it, is, look, the government uses of currency tend to be as a lever of government power. And that is another goal of Bitcoin, is to remove that power that governments have over currency. I mean, the power to create more dollars, to inflate away the value of what you hold. Bitcoin is expressly – and there are other currencies, we'll talk about them, that are not expressly this. But Bitcoin is expressly designed to be anti-inflationary, in fact, deflationary. There's a set number of Bitcoins that are supposed to be created over the next 100 years or so if the system keeps going that long. So the idea is that this is not an inflationary currency. It cannot be used by any party to sort of slowly and invisibly whittle away your buying power.
Paul Vigna of The Wall Street Journal, you mentioned earlier that some people consider it a currency, some a commodity. It is both. But I think that's worth noting because whereas some people are purchasing it to actually buy and sell things with it, other people simply seem to be looking at it as an investment, something they hope will appreciate and they'll sell. I don't think they intend to use it for daily currency activities. Is that fair to say?
That is fair to say, and it's still look, actually, everything with Bitcoin, when you look at it in terms of traditional capital markets, it is still a very small market. But there is a growing use case, you would say, as this is, you know, sort of a digital store of value. It's a gold 2.0 is what they'll tell you it is. And you have a couple of people offering there's one exchange-traded fund that's traded over the market here. There's an exchange-traded note that comes out of a Swedish firm. There are people that are trying to make a case that this is sort of your digital hedge. What gold is for you traditionally, your hedge against inflation, your hedge against geopolitical crises, this is a digital version of that. And they're trying to make that case, and they're trying to get Wall Street, they're trying to get the traditional financial system interested. And they are having some successes and some setbacks. And it's, you know, it's an interesting idea. The question is, I mean, it's certainly something that can only be proven out by a very long track record.
The Bitcoin and all types of alternative currencies were very much on the fringe of finance for a while. The early adopters were the highly computer literate, the techies. But it's definitely becoming more mainstream. And as an example of that, Bill Gates in October 2014 did an interview with Bloomberg Street Smart in which he said he liked Bitcoin because of how convenient he considers it to be. So let's hear what Bill Gates had to say.
Bitcoin is exciting because it shows how cheap it can be. Bitcoin is better than currency in that you don't have to be physically in the same place. And, of course, for large transactions, currency can get pretty inconvenient.
Abby Johnson, the CEO of Fidelity Investments, was at a digital currency conference in New York last month. She said, I love this stuff. So we have people like the Fidelity CEO and Bill Gates saying they like it. We also have a lot of major online retailers beginning to accept Bitcoin as currency. One of them is Overstock.com. It began accepting Bitcoin as payment for goods in 2014. That made it one of the first retailers to do so. Let's hear a piece of sound from Overstock.com's founder and CEO, Patrick Byrne, in which he explains why he's drawn to the digital currency.
The issue is, if you believe in limited government, which I know you do, you need a monetary system that doesn't give them unlimited power. You need a tie. The monetary system is like an upside-down pyramid. You want it tied to something like gold that they can't just make, government mandarins can't just whisk into existence. Or with Bitcoin, it's mathematically limited, not physically limited, but you get money that's based on something that's limited and that mandarins can't create out of nowhere.
Now, Paul Vigna, even that explanation by the Overstock.com founder suggests that this is quite a complicated currency.
Yeah, it is. And look, I mean, Bill Gates' interest in it is obviously notable, but there are a few people on the planet more technologically savvy than Bill Gates. So, you know, he doesn't exactly represent the kind of everyman that might be interested in this. And I think there is still a significant barrier. I think awareness of it generally has increased over the years. I think awareness of it in financial circles has increased. You know, it's probably almost 100%. I doubt you could go anywhere on Wall Street and ask people about Bitcoin and have them say, oh, no, I never heard about that. I never read an article about it. In the general public, I would say maybe 50%, probably more than 50% of the people have heard of it. A very small portion of the people have actually used it. People are still trying to figure out exactly what it is, which is why we're doing this entire program.
Paul, you mentioned earlier, Paul, that there's someone else in the studio with you. That's another guest. That's Felix Salmon. He's a senior editor at Fusion. He's with you in New York.
Hi, Sasha.
Hi, Felix. How are you doing? So you are you've been very open about your skepticism about Bitcoin. Tell us why you think that this might be a lot of hype.
Well, Paul was hinting at a few of these reasons. For one thing, you know, for all that people dislike inflation, that's mainly because they've never experienced deflation. Deflation is much, much worse than inflation. In a deflationary economy, you just don't spend anything today because you know it's going to be cheaper tomorrow. And as Paul said, Bitcoin is inherently deflationary, and that would be economically disastrous. It's also not a commodity in the sense of anything which has any real cash flow or use associated with it. It's not like oil or copper or, you know, coal or anything that you might be able to use in the real world. It's a purely speculative bet. The only thing I can think of which is even close might be art, perhaps. Something that has no real intrinsic value at all, and you're only, if you're using, financializing it, just trying to sell it to a greater fool. But those things, you know, have a limited utility, you might say.
You've also...
Also, I will add one other thing, is that when Bill Gates was talking about how easy and cheap it was to... send Bitcoin around the world, that was 2014. And we have seen that the architecture of Bitcoin has had enormous difficulty scaling, and it's actually becoming much more time-consuming and more expensive to make Bitcoin transactions than anyone expected a few years ago.
Although, you know, even though we heard a piece of sound earlier from the CEO of Overstock.com, even some relatively small businesses are accepting it. We have a piece of sound from a restaurant owner in San Diego. His name is Sean Cole. He told KPBS television in 2014 why his business started accepting Bitcoin as payment several years ago.
If there is a segment of patrons that want to spend Bitcoins, and it makes no difference to us whether we accept it and convert it into U.S. currency, we've made a patron happy, and then we've established our goal, our mission. I think another thing is that it's easily to convert using the Coinbase software, and the fees are much less using a Bitcoin conversion versus traditional Visa or MasterCard.
So it requires a certain learning curve to use. But Felix Salmon, you've said that you think the average person is going to find it far too complex to use for daily purchases.
So I will point out that both of those pieces of tape from your chap in San Diego and from Patrick Byrne date from 2014. There was a bunch of hype about Bitcoin in 2014, which I fear I might have contributed to. And now, in the 3 years since then, very little has actually happened in broad retail adoption. I think no, people aren't using it like that.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about digital currencies and the skyrocketing price lately of Bitcoin. Join this conversation. Let us know if you're concerned about the reputation of cryptocurrency, something we'll be talking about later this hour, whether you associate it mostly with illegal online activity. Do you think this is hype over alternative currency, an investment bubble, or a legitimate investment? I'm talking with Wall Street Journal reporter Paul Vigna, who wrote the book The Age of Cryptocurrency. And with Paul in the studio in New York City is Felix Salmon, a senior editor at Fusion. He's a Bitcoin skeptic. You can read Felix's in-depth blog post about the Bitcoin bubble and the future of alternative currency at our website, onpointradio.org. Paul and Felix, welcome back. Paul, yep. We've been talking mostly about Bitcoin, but there are many other alternative currencies emerging: Litecoin, Dash, Zcash, Monero. There's soon apparently something called Kin. Give us a sense of what else is out there and how much market share do they really have?
Congratulations for naming like half a dozen of them.
Is that pretty much all, right?
No, actually, it's far from all.
Oh, really?
It's not easy to – yeah. Hey, you know, I really quickly – I don't want to belabor this point, but we were talking about the retail case before, and I think what's really interesting is a lot of this does go back to 2014, but I mean, I was talking to the CEO of Cheap Air maybe 2 months ago, and they take it, and he loves it, and he said Bitcoin – these Bitcoin customers are more loyal. They spend more. He likes the fact that it is very easy for his company to integrate into their website and easy for them to use. There's no credit card risk to the merchant. So there are reasons why merchants are very high on this, and especially if they're doing their business online.
And the
other interesting thing to watch is going to be what happens in Japan, because the Japanese government – on April 1st, put in laws that legitimize Bitcoin as a payment method, not as a legal currency, not the equal of the yen, but as a payment method. And a lot of Japanese businesses are starting to accept it. And I think if you're going to see this take off as a payment method, and this really underscores the fact that Bitcoin is a global currency, it's going to be very interesting to watch what happens in Japan.
So I need to jump in here and say that Cheap Air sells airline tickets, which are one of those things which exist in the future. You buy, you spend money now for a product which isn't going to arrive for a couple months' time. And Bitcoin is irreversible. If you buy your airline ticket with a credit card and the airline goes bust, the credit card will refund you your money. If you buy it with Bitcoin, you have spent that money. You have no recourse. And that is great for merchants, but it's not necessarily good for actual consumers.
But many merchants have signed on. I was looking at a list. It's long and it's mainstream. Victoria's Secret, Amazon, the App Store, CVS, Kmart, PayPal. I mean, this is mainstream for many
of them. Right. I mean, look, not every company is an airline that's going to go bust. So, I mean, there are good reasons why merchants are interested in it. To Felix's point, though, a lot of this does date back to 2014. And I think one thing you can't deny with Bitcoin is that the adoption, both on the merchant side and the consumer side, has been slower than people expected. That doesn't mean that there's not a case for it. And again, like I said, once you start getting governments recognizing this as a legitimate way to pay bills, not government taxes, but bills, it'll be really interesting to see where it goes.
So back to the other types of alternative currency. What else is out there, Paul?
Oh my God. There's probably about 800 of them now. Most of them, Sasha, are absolutely valueless and useless and will never go anywhere.
And are three people using 750 of the 800?
Well, three people might be trading. I mean, they have no actual day-to-day utility. They're really just kind of pump and dump scams. Most of them are useless. Some of them are not useless. The most important one probably is Ether, which is the currency used on the Ethereum network, which is it's a network that is similar to Bitcoin, except the way Bitcoin is written, Bitcoin is supposed to be software that supports a currency. Ethereum is software that is supposed to support a hosting service for apps. It's basically like a virtual computer. That's a really interesting one. And the price of Ethereum, I think, has gone up like tenfold in the last couple of months. Ripple is another one. Ripple is it's a network being used for interbank payments. So that's a slightly different case. It's a specialized case. That's an interesting one as well. The value question there is highly questionable because it's not really supposed to be a store of value. It's just supposed to be a coin that you use to get onto this network.
By the way, I made a note before as I was prepping for this. I made a note that Ethereum, you mentioned its increase, went from less than $20 in March to about $170 today.
Right.
And this is quite common in the cryptocurrency space. They are extremely volatile, which is a bad thing if you want them to be a currency.
Let's go to some callers. We have a lot of people who want to weigh in. Brady is calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Brady, is this world of alternative currency one you've dipped your toe into?
Yes. Hi, this is Brady. I am a huge fan of Ethereum, and I'm so glad that you guys are talking about it.
And why do you use it, and what do you use it for?
So I use Ethereum just as a early investment for me. A friend of mine who was an early investor in Bitcoin had told me about it a few months ago, and I had a few extra dollars, so I threw it in. And as you mentioned, its value has skyrocketed. I think I just checked a few minutes ago. It's at like $230 today. It doesn't have any current utility for me because I'm not someone that needs a massive amount of computing power. But I have this faith that it will be power the next generation of the internet.
But it sounds like you simply hope to make money off it. Is that what you want to do?
I did it So I did it. I threw $50 in and was just seeing how it could grow. But I believe in its utility as a world computer. So if you can think of Bitcoin as like a replacement for fiat for any other currency released by a government, Ethereum is meant to be like an architecture that the internet will run on. It is what will power, if you're familiar with like IBM Watson as like a supercomputer, Ethereum is pulling computer sources from everyone that is linked up to these nodes and allowing to run these massive processing power things using a whole bunch of different computers instead of one server room.
Brady, thanks for that. And Paul and Felix, I have a practical investment question related to Brady's comment. So it sounds like his investment has appreciated substantially. If he wants to cash in, is that liquid? Can he easily sell that tomorrow? Is there a market to buy what he's bought?
He could sell it tomorrow. How liquid it is would depend exactly on what exchange he goes to, where he goes. You know, I mean, Ethereum and Bitcoin are relatively liquid. It's not really like, especially the amount that he would be trying to sell if he wanted to cash in is not a lot. He probably wouldn't have a lot of trouble selling that. If you wanted to move large amounts of Bitcoin or Ethereum, you know, again, depending on what exchange you're on, the other ones are far less liquid. And that's one of the real risks is You have some of these new coins coming about and raising tens of millions of dollars in very little amount of time, and there is no market for these things. And if people try to sell out, they absolutely will have no way to do it. That's going to be a problem down the road.
And then just to put this in context, the international currency markets move like $14 trillion right. a day. So it's not even a blip in terms of the amount of money that gets moved in real commerce every day.
Let's go to another caller. This is Peter from Stamford, Connecticut. Peter, welcome to On Point. And are you into the world of cryptocurrency?
No, I'm not. But I have so many questions. I'm just wondering, can you get paid? If you're an employee, can you get paid with Bitcoin if the employer is on the Bitcoin, point with Bitcoin. How does it work with payroll taxes? Can you buy a house? Can you buy a car? Can you get a Bitcoin loan how does this merge into the old economy?
Such good questions.
I'm going to go to my HR director. I'm going to be paid in Bitcoin, instead of, and put it on a 401k and how does it work with Social Security and this government? In the U.S. and where I'm calling from in Connecticut, they're broke. We need, everybody needs tax. Taxes are going up. How's it going to affect property taxes? How's it going to affect social? I mean, is it going to work the real economy? I mean, what's going on?
Those are great questions. So let's break them down. So the first question.
Those are great questions, which I will be able to definitively answer in about 10 or 15 years.
The first bit I will say is do not, whatever you do, ever take out a loan in Bitcoin, because your earning power ultimately, at least for the foreseeable future, is going to be in dollars. And if the price of Bitcoin goes up from, $2,000 to $20,000, the amount you need to pay back has suddenly gone up 10 times, and there's no way you're ever going to be able to pay it back. So note that the lending markets in Bitcoin not only do not exist, they will not exist basically ever. In terms of the other stuff, it's generally used as a proxy for dollars. So you hold Bitcoin for a short amount of time, and then you convert it back into dollars. And for people actually holding Bitcoin bank accounts and being paid in a set number of Bitcoins, I've never really heard of
that. So Peter say to his employer, when I get my paycheck on Thursday, please give it to me in Bitcoin?
He could say it. I doubt they would do it.
The other thing is, if
Peter worked for an Ethereum or Bitcoin startup, he could get paid in Ethereum and Bitcoin. I mean, the startups do it, and there are a few people that they'll tell you my day to day life is Bitcoin. My day to life, not Ethereum, but Bitcoin.
Could he go to a car dealer and say, "I want to buy my Toyota Camry in Bitcoin"?
You could, and I'll tell you, there are so few of them that when it happens, we actually would end up writing a story about it. Hey, someone sold a house for Bitcoin. Somebody bought a car for Bitcoin. The idea of Bitcoin is that this is a peer-to-peer network. It is direct between people, no intermediaries, right? So if Peter wanted to buy a house and he went to somebody and said, I'd like to pay for that house in Bitcoin, and the other person was a Bitcoin aficionado and said, hey, you know what? I will take that payment in Bitcoin. They could affect that transaction in Bitcoin. They would then eventually, if they want to really get the money out, they would have to transfer it back into dollars, which takes another step. But it can happen, and it happens in very limited cases. Again, because this is a really important point to understand about this, is all of this is very nascent still, and it is very experimental, and it may go places, it may go no place. If you think about the internet was created in the 60s by a bunch of scientists in a lab somewhere, and it took off in the 90s. So this is all it's all very experimental, but it is a live experiment. It just kind of was pushed out into the world, and it's happening. So you are watching a live experiment. So it's very, very interesting. It's very fascinating. You can hear Peter's got all these questions about it.
And
he's
so,
clearly intrigued.
I just sold a house, right? And let's say I sold it to someone who had a whole bunch of Bitcoin and wanted to use his Bitcoin to buy my house. In that case, there are basically two different ways that could happen. He could sell his Bitcoin for dollars and give me the dollars, which is the normal way that you would do it. Or he could go weird and say, would you accept the Bitcoin? And I'd be like, I guess. And then I would just take the Bitcoin and convert them into dollars and get dollars either way. The fact that he paid for it in Bitcoin or dollars is not actually that interesting.
Let's go to Chandra calling from Ironwood, Michigan. Welcome to On Point. And are you into this world?
Hi there. It's interesting that you guys are doing this show today, because It was just a couple days ago. I have a small market or a small little shop here in Ironwood, and it was just a couple days ago that somebody asked me, do you take Bitcoin? And I had a wallet from like 2013, and I opened it up, and sure enough, it was still active, and I was able to take that Bitcoin. And another thing is I work in the medical marijuana industry here in Michigan, which is, you know, it's hard to get federally backed banking if you use banking, regular mainstream banking for this industry. It's the federal overreach is very real, and it can be something that this industry fears. So for there to be a secondary currency that people can use and then instantly switch into cash, I think that's it's a real thing. I think it's a real good thing, and it can become popular within industries like the medical marijuana.
Chandra,
industry.
Thank you for that. And I have a vocabulary question because you made a reference to a wallet. Now, Paul and Felix, I'm assuming we're not talking about something leather she took out of her pocket.
Right.
This is a different...
Yeah, the first thing I would say is, Chandra, if you've been sitting on that Bitcoin since 2013, you made a lot of money. Like, you really did well holding on to it for 4 years. I don't know if she's still on the line, but she doesn't have to tell us what she made. But, I mean, in 2013, it was trading $100, something
less.
Like that? Less, yeah. Right, depending on what time. So she did really well. Yeah, a wallet is really just – it's a nickname for a digital account. That's all it really is. It's an online account. It's really no different than if you have an online account at JP Morgan. I mean, that's what it is. They just call it a wallet. The interesting thing – she said she's in the medical marijuana business. The interesting thing is I think in 2014, early on in 2014, I was going to do a story about Bitcoin and marijuana because it seemed really interesting. Here are two industries that are trying to grow that are on the outskirts of the law, outskirts of the banking system. And I thought, this will be great. These are two industries that could use each other, could help each other grow. And there was a dispensary in Colorado that was trying to use Bitcoin because they couldn't get bank accounts. People were walking in with tons of cash. It was really dangerous for them. And I thought this was going to be a great story, and the story fell apart. Because what happened was the marijuana people are looking for some kind of legitimacy, and they didn't want to be associated with Bitcoin. And the Bitcoin people were looking for some kind of legitimacy and didn't want to be associated with the medical marijuana industry. So these two industries that were distrusted by outside authorities, they were looking for that legitimacy from outside authorities, so they wanted nothing to do with each other, and the whole thing went nowhere.
This is a broader problem with Bitcoin, which I've been talking about from the beginning, is that it is based on mistrust, and currencies are based on trust. And one of the features of Bitcoin from day one is that you don't need to trust any other party. But it turns out that in lots of everyday relationships and financial relationships, actually you want a little bit of trust. It really helps.
I would say I think that's probably changed in the years since I did that story. I mean, some of the more responsible exchanges and wallet services, and they've gone out. They've got trust charters.
Yeah, exactly.
They've got licenses.
They've been inserting
trust into
the system.
Right. And it has been changing since 2013, 2014.
And I will also say that in terms of just accepting Bitcoin for payments, this is pretty much a solved problem at this point. One of the biggest payments companies in the world is called Stripe. They take Bitcoin. PayPal takes Bitcoin. So if someone wants to pay you with Bitcoin and you have a PayPal account, then hey, they can pay you.
Let's hear one more piece of sound before we go to a break. This is a bar in Manhattan, one of the few there that accepts Bitcoin. It's called Old Man Hustle. And the bar owner told CNN last week why he believes that this currency is going to pave the way for the future of monetary transactions.
When Napster came out, it failed, but it also set up the future for digital music. And I believe that to be the same case for Bitcoin.
Felix Paul True, is this sort of the pioneer that's paving the way?
The interesting thing is a lot of people talk about when is Bitcoin going to have its Napster moment? And some people will say, well, it's happening now. You know, you look at the price, you look at wider trends, it's happening. Some people say it is yet to happen. It is the thing that people are waiting for this
Wait,
thing.
The Napster moment being the bit where it all just collapses?
Being the day that the sort of the really simple user-friendly interface comes along that makes this thing so easy to use that people can do it without having to think about it or understand sort of the technology behind it. I don't think that has really happened quite yet. I still think what you have is a lot of speculation going on.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the growing popularity of Bitcoin and other alternative currencies. Join this conversation. Let us know if these alternative forms of payment have a place in your life. Are you actually exchanging them, buying things with them, or is it just an investment? Are you hoping to make money off it? Were you an early adopter, or are you tempted? Still with us are Paul Vigna at the Wall Street Journal, who covers Bitcoin and digital currencies, and Felix Salmon, a senior editor at Fusion, who is a Bitcoin doubter. And now a third person joins us. This is Ben Lee. He is what you might call a cryptocurrency enthusiast. He's CEO and co-founder of the mobile app development company Neon Roots. He joins us from Los Angeles and uses both Bitcoin and Ether. Ben Lee, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Sasha. How's it going, gentlemen?
It's good. Good. Thanks, Ben.
So, Ben, tell us what you use these for, how you use them, how much they're a part of your life.
Absolutely. I mean, I got in around 2012, 2013. I've taken Bitcoin for services in the tech community. I think there's also a novel side to it where you're a more progressive company. People are attracted to it. You get potentially some PR out of it. So I think that's another reason why retailers are presumably wanting to get into the cryptocurrency space. I used to be a trader more on the Bitcoin side. I've gotten more active with Ethereum, I'd say, in the past couple months. My story on Forbes went viral. And it wasn't an attack on Bitcoin. I'm the biggest, crypto anarchist supporter. But much like what we've been talking about, what you guys have been talking about, there's brand issues with Bitcoin.
Yeah, in fact,
we got a lot of reputational problems.
Very much so. In fact, we have a listener on Twitter, Keith MacArthur, who referenced Bitcoin and said that it seems to him that its anonymity enables dangerous and costly cyber attacks. And we have seen Bitcoin associated with online drug markets. Silk Road was one of them.
Right.
Ransomware, this recent WannaCry computer virus. So that's problematic for the brand and the reputation of digital currencies in general.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what, when I was trading in 2013, I have a very old school dad who, barely knows that he's a computer. And he's telling me, what are you doing, Benny, buying this stuff with this Bitcoin and the Russians and, people are, holding ransom. And let's not forget that Bitcoin didn't know it was going to scale like this. Bitcoin's largest exchange, which was hacked, Mt. Gox, was Magic the Gathering Online Exchange. So this is a group of hackers, crypto anarchists, whatever you want to call them, who didn't know it would pop the way it has.
You referenced Mt. Gox. That was the largest Bitcoin exchange. And when it did collapse, there was a big crash that occurred. So we've been talking about people who've made money on Bitcoin.
Luckily, I was able to minimize my downside. But a lot of people lost a lot of money.
Yeah, exactly. So Paul Vigna and Felix Salmon, how much concern should people have about this currency possibly fueling online crime and the anonymity it offers that could be a negative thing?
So, I mean, WannaCry, which you just talked about, the ransomware, is a good example. It caused billions of dollars of economic damage. There were hospitals across the UK, the entire Russian Interior Ministry, and basically it was a complete fluke that it didn't cause massive economic damage in the US as well. And the economic benefits to the ransomware operators were tiny, but the economic effects were huge and negative. And no one could run this kind of a scheme without Bitcoin. So it's bad in that sense.
Well, but I mean, ransomware wasn't invented with Bitcoin. I mean, it existed before Bitcoin, and they did it before Bitcoin.
But it is scaled up much, much bigger than it ever was in the pre-Bitcoin era because if you pay a ransom using the banking system, then it can be traced and it's quite easy to catch the perpetrator.
Let's hear from a listener on this. This is Steve calling from Wilmington, Massachusetts. Steve, do you have concerns about alternative currencies for the reasons we're talking about?
Absolutely. I think it's a horrible idea. The only check on criminal activity is the fact that it can be traced through banking systems. To enable criminal organizations of scale to use an untraceable currency is a terrible idea. I don't know how we in a civilized society could even consider that to be an appropriate use of the digital economy at all.
Pauline, the thing of it is, it's not a perfectly anonymous system. And there's a guy named Ross Ulbricht who's going to spend the rest of his life in jail because it is not anonymous. What Bitcoin does is, you don't have to tie your identity to the transactions, right? What you get is, the account is controlled by a public key and a private key. As long as you have access to the private key, you can make transactions with that wallet. Every transaction that is done within the Bitcoin network is publicly broadcast and it can all be followed. Your identity may not be known, but if authorities can tie your identity to that private key, to those transactions, they have everything you ever did in Bitcoin. And that's exactly what happened with Ulbricht. He was running the Silk Road website and he was anonymous for a while. They figured out who he was. And then when they got him into court, they had every transaction he had done on that website. And he went to jail. And now he's going to go to jail for the rest of his life. So Bitcoin is actually, it's really not a perfect vehicle for criminals, especially not on any kind of large scale. The WannaCry guys, they got about $100,000. Yes, they did a lot of damage through it, but it's not really quite as lucrative as it sounds.
Ben Lee, you were trying to jump in there.
And it's more dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, it's really when you're trying to take your Bitcoins and convert it to dollars, whether it's through a local wallet, whether it's through Coinbase, whether whatever means. At that point, you're needing to put your identity attached to your Bitcoin transaction.
Right.
Every transaction, you know, as we said, is logged in this general ledger on blockchain. So in that respect, it's totally anonymous. We're just seeing a bunch of keys move and, you know, quantities. But at the point at which, you know, we want to take that money out, whether it's, you know, BitPremier or Coinbase or one of these others, I mean, you need to have your social security, you need to have tax forms, you need to put your identity in front of that in order to convert it to U.S. dollars. And then at that point, it's completely traceable.
Let's hear from another caller. This is Dan from Baltimore, Maryland. Dan, welcome to On Point and your thoughts as you listen to this conversation.
Hi, Sasha. My thoughts are everybody keeps going back to how important it is to convert it into dollars when really the goal is to never have to bring it back into dollars again, to leave it in Bitcoin and be able to use it for purchase power there.
Do you use Bitcoin?
I'm holding on to it for now. I have used it in the past during the last rise, but I've seen a lot of rises and falls, and I knew that if I stick with it, it could get higher.
And what was the appeal to you originally for getting into the exchange?
I actually got into Bitcoin when it was right around a dollar because I thought it seemed kind of interesting and did the math and figured out that if I ran it on my computer, I could make some money if I left it running all day while I was working. And eventually that paid off. I watched it go from $1 to $20, and I was totally ecstatic, telling everybody, trying to get everybody into it. And, then it rose to 100, then 1,000, then 1,200. I, at the time, used Bitcoin to buy a bunch of gift cards to Amazon so I could pick up a lot of home appliances. And that was probably the most fiat money I've spent with Bitcoin. I've purchased a few other things online from vendors that accepted Bitcoin. It's been pretty fun.
Paul and Felix, is it fair to say that there are considerable risks with Bitcoin? Because whereas if you have more traditional currency, there are protections built in. If someone were to withdraw money from your bank account, the bank can often protect you. Are those protections really not here? Is it like putting your money in a mattress?
Again, this has changed a little bit over the years. When our caller first set up an account in 2011 or 2012 or whenever it was, you needed to basically download the entire program onto your computer, which I did actually, and I wound up having to delete it because it was so enormous that ledger became just unwieldy. And when you do that, if your computer gets hacked, and has happened many times, and your thousands of Bitcoins get stolen, then you have no recourse. increasingly that, and increasingly the companies which intermediate that step now, like people like Coinbase, will give you a little bit of recourse. So you have a little bit of trust there. But to a degree, that kind of defeats the purpose of having Bitcoin in the first place.
Paul Vigna, as I'm imagining listeners listening to this thinking, this sounds really risky. What are the barriers, in your view, to this ever going truly mainstream?
Oh, what are the barriers? Well, I mean, certainly security, the security of your funds is a barrier because Felix is right. It has changed. It is easier to do it now. But by the same token, the hackers have gotten more sophisticated. I literally read a story this morning about a guy who said that somebody got a hold of his Verizon wireless access, transferred his account to their phone, and then went into his Coinbase account and stole all his Bitcoin. So,
and no recourse for him.
Yeah, no recourse. I mean, it's gone. Like the transfer is done. The transaction is done. The immutability of Bitcoin, this idea that you can't change the transaction ledger, which is a feature, at that point becomes a detriment to you. So security is definitely probably the biggest risk, really. I mean, the fact that, you know, you could use a product that would make this easier for people. Like there's no sort of – there isn't a Netscape of Bitcoin yet. There isn't a WeChat of Bitcoin yet.
And there's more to the point, there's no FDIC. There's no
right.
banking regulators. There's no government entities standing behind it and saying you need to make this whole.
They can with two-factor authentication, with security to try to make it as secure as possible. With hacking, as we all know, when somebody gets hacked, it's likely human error. They have their passwords floating around. So Bitcoin itself is not going to get hacked. It's your wallet that's going to get hacked.
Right, but it's the same. Exactly. It's the same thing if you wind up getting hacked. And that's exactly my point, is that there's a handful of people who love computers, who trust themselves, who think that human error is not going to happen to me. And for them, okay, fine, go ahead and do Bitcoin. Most of us realize that we're fallible and say, I don't want to run that risk.
Let's talk to someone else. Let's talk to someone else who's taken the plunge. And this is Dane calling from here in Boston. Dane, tell us about you and what you do in terms of the world of cryptocurrency.
So I was actually a longtime Bitcoin skeptic. My roommates were trying to get me into it for years. And it wasn't until a couple months ago we started diving into all of these altcoins on these other exchanges, and everybody, you know, in the troll box or in crypto Shrek swamp are trying to find the next coin that's going to be the Bitcoin. So everybody wants these coins that are at fractions of cents or a little under a dollar. And we've all seen some of them. You know, we put in a couple $100s and it becomes a couple $1,000s. So it's sort of just a day trading thing now. Not really any utilization, but just looking for the technology that's going to be the next one to take off.
Have you been able to cash in, or are you just watching value go up and down on a screen?
If I see any time I make a decent amount of money on one of the coins, sometimes I will cash out, put it into a different coin, but I haven't cashed out in dollars yet. But I guess everybody has their price, and at some point I'll probably take my gains and get out.
So did you go from Bitcoin skeptic and jump right over Bitcoin and go into the altcoins?
I did. I went head first in. I don't currently hold any Bitcoin. I hold exclusively altcoins.
Here's a question for you, because we're going to talk about the rise in price of Bitcoin at some point, I'm sure. In order to buy these altcoins, did you first convert dollars into Bitcoin and then convert the Bitcoins into altcoins?
Yeah.
Or did you buy? Yeah. Right.
Well, let me jump in because I think we're getting very technical. When we say altcoins, are we talking about any currency other than Bitcoin?
Exactly. Well, any cryptocurrency other than Bitcoin.
And
I feel like
Ethereum coins now. So they don't know that you can buy altcoins through Bitcoin, or they don't know you can fraction off Bitcoin. So they look at the price, $2,000. Oh my gosh, I can't afford that. So I'm going to get in through Ethereum, Ether, and then start buying altcoins.
You know, as I listen to the three of you talk, I keep thinking again that for the average person, this is going to sound so complicated. It's not just like dollars in your wallet, that I'm really beginning to wonder, what is it ever going to take for this to become more than largely a fringe hobbyist.
Sasha, it's a fringe hobbyist speculative thing. Look at the people who are calling in. They're all like, I bought Bitcoins really early and then I made money. Like, this is the only use case anyone's come up with for Bitcoin is I bought it and held onto it and did nothing with it and now I'm richer than I was.
I think there's something to that, but also there's something to the fact that, you know, 100 years ago, cars were the same way. Nobody understood what cars were. They were afraid of them. There were laws passed in towns that they couldn't be on the same road.
But you still drove them. You still drove them.
The thing of it is that, yeah, it had purpose. The car had a utility. Does Bitcoin and this kind of currency have a utility in the 21st century? I think it does. And I think in the years to come, it's going to be proven out.
Ben's getting drowned out because he has the weakest line. Ben, you take over here. What do you think about all this?
When you don't have people using it in commerce, that's the problem. We just heard from a caller who said, you know, I just hold on to it. I don't do anything with it. I buy some things with it. That's the problem. There's no real commerce or marketplace. I buy $20 transactions with Bitcoin. I buy $50 transactions with Bitcoin. I try to be the super evangelist and get, you know, promos or whatever from Coinbase for signing up people. That's how you create a community and people using it. The hardcore Bitcoin enthusiasts aren't using it. They're just hoarding it. They're holding on to it. And that's the problem. We're not seeing...
Sasha, can I mention my bet?
Sure, please.
So 3.5 years ago, I came on NPR and had a bet with this chap called Ben Horowitz, who runs Andreessen Horowitz, which is a big venture capital company out in Silicon Valley. And he's funded a bunch of Bitcoin companies, primarily this one called 21, which no one really knows what it does. And he said that, and the bet was that in 5 years' time, which is about 18 months from now, that 10% of the American population would have used Bitcoin to buy something. There's no way he's going to win that bet.
So we will try to check back with you. When should we check back with you? Do you have an end date for when this bet
ends? January 2019.
January 2018. We're booking you for a show that month, that year. Felix Salmon, senior editor at Fusion, thank you very much. Also, Paul Vigna from The Wall Street Journal, a cryptocurrency reporter. He covers that world. Thank you to you. And Ben Lee in Los Angeles, a software developer who has immersed himself in this world. Thank you very much to all three of you and to all the callers who called in.
Thank you, Sasha.
Thanks, Sasha.
You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, our Week in the News roundtable. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.